Good evening and welcome to the Icecast. My name is Shane Chebsey, and on the Icecast we talk to artists, writers and publishers about their work, their lives and everything in between, within reason. And this evening on the Icecast I'm very happy to welcome Emma Vicelli. Hi Emma, how are you?
I like to bring my own fanfare.
That's very good. You're the first person to do that.
We all need to find ways to cheer ourselves up in 2020, Shane, and I feel like we should all have our own unique fanfare.
That's really good. I'll have to think about what to do for mine now, because you've just stole the best.
What would yours be?
Yeah, I don't know. So, probably.
Shane's here. I think you'd have like a kind of, I don't know.
Well, actually, I could use the theme tune to this, couldn't I? Because start this, there is actually a theme tune. We haven't heard it, but when you listen back, there is a, like a rocky theme tune. So
there you go. And then when we all come back together finally next year, it's going to be like wrestling, and we'll all walk into our
arms up, yeah, banners high,
into the bar.
Like, what are all these mad people doing? All the normal people will be like, oh, there must be a comic convention.
Yes, be thinking, everyone. Get your theme tunes ready.
Great idea. Let's see if we can perpetuate it amongst comicdom. See what everybody out there, send us your theme tunes.
So as you can see, this year has not affected my brain at all.
Well, if you'd not been affected by this year, there would be something to worry about, I think.
This is true.
Think any rational person is going to be affected by this level of change to their normal routine. So anyway, but this is 2020. And
it's
I would like to go way back into the mists of time, back to 2000 and, well, initially, I think we'll go back to 2007, I think it was.
Oh, wow, back.
Which was the year that I first became aware of you as a creative force.
Oh.
And it was through the guys at Manga. Because we were doing a screening of the new Naruto film at the time, I think.
I love the idea of a live screening.
Yeah, a live screening.
It's real.
So, and the guy who was like representing Manga, I can't remember who he
Jerome?
Was. Yes,
Jerome. Yes. Jerome. Yeah,
you've got
Jerome.
A really good memory. Yeah, Jerome. Hi, Jerome, if you're out there. So he said to me, it would be really good if Emma Vicelli was the host. And I said, who's that?
Fair. Absolutely fair.
And so I had to find out who you were, and I looked it up, and I saw predominantly at the time then, you were known for your TV stuff that you'd done, I think. Anime shows.
Yeah, well, I used to work, so me and Stu Claw, who did a lot of the stuff, the presenting for MCM as well, we worked together with Hugh David at the time of ADV, and basically we had a channel called the Anime Network, which was just a bunch of nerds presenting anime for TV. Yeah. It was amazing. It was a bit of a sort of dream come true. We got to all, I think we only filmed every, we'd sort of do like a mammoth filming session every couple of months, like save it up. And we'd all go to this sort of hotel in the middle of nowhere, and there was a studio nearby. It was really lovely, actually. I lose track of the timelines myself, to be honest.
It's incredible, isn't it? You don't realise how much time has gone by. Because, I mean, we're talking sort of 2006, 2007, I think.
That would make sense. Because I think because my like training and background was more in the performance stuff, like comics was a really lucky, happy accident, like the luckiest, happiest accident. And actually, if anything, in fact, how weird is this? I did not think we'd talk about Anime Network at all. But to jump way forward and then we'll jump way back again. I am currently finally embarking on my first comic with Paul Cornell, lovely Paul, who I've always known for many years, and we've wanted to work together for ages. And the reason we first met is I can remember at Bristol being in the bar, and Paul, whose work I knew at the time anyway, and it would have been in about 2007-ish, I guess, came up to me in the bar and said, you're Emma Vicelli from Anime Network. And that was how he...
That's how he knew you as well.
Which is so weird to think now. And I was like, oh my God, you're Paul Cornell. So yeah, that's so everything goes in circles, doesn't it?
But
yeah, but I think there was a point early on when I started to there's no way to say it without sounding ungrateful. Presenting was like really fun, but it wasn't ever what I expected to do. So
yeah.
There was a point where like,
how did it come about then? How did that all start, the presenting?
We started not with Anime Network, but with it was when I was at uni, good old uni. I was doing performing arts up in Cumbria, and the local ITV locally just held open auditions for a kids TV presenter.
Yeah.
And I went along. Why not?
Yeah, why not?
A go, and ended up getting this gig, which in hindsight was like the luckiest, jammiest student gig you could have hoped for. Like, I would literally, my now husband, Pud, who you know, who's sitting on the settee listening to me right now.
Hey, Pud.
We would like, because I would film, this was for a show called The Nitty and Gritty Club up in Carlisle, which I for ITV, which was great fun. And literally, I'd film a bunch of stings, and we'd film for like an hour on a Friday morning. And every Friday morning, I'd be like, "Oh, I don't want to go to work." And what?
Oh, really?
Just get in a car, sit in a makeup room, have lovely people do my hair.
Oh, it's hard life, isn't it? Yeah.
Sit in a big comfy chair and read birthday cards and things. And
he was so hard working.
No, he was working at Costa like every hour he could, and he's just like, "Go to work, you." I was awful.
Oh.
So that was how it started. It was very unexpected and really lovely. And then, when I moved back down here, we talked about transferring stuff over. And this is so not to do with comics, but my random fun presenting story is I once presented live for something. It was ITV's Record of the Year, which was the only time I've done live TV. Oh. And in a true Emma Vicelli fashion, it has appalling stories to go with it. It was terrifying. It was like a bunch of the regional, you know, when people do the whole, and here are the votes from the Southeast and here. So it was that kind of job. So you had Anton Deck doing the presenting the main show.
I think I remember that show. I do actually remember.
Yeah, it used to be on every year, I think. Mm. And Andy Peters was directing it. So I literally had Anton Deck in one ear and Andy Peters in the other, your monitors, which is very weird. And you're only expected to speak for all of 5 minutes or something. You know, it's 5 minutes. And I was so out of my depth and terrified, and we'd all brought our own earpieces, and in the sound check was like, quickly everyone would take turns getting on a stool, check sound, move on. And I'm on this thing with this head, my little, you know, my own little headpiece, going like, I can't hear anything at all, can't hear it. And they're fiddling with all these buttons, like, can you still not hear anything? I'm not getting the feed. And then one of them said, just a thought, can we just have a look at your earpiece? And I took it out, and it was minging and blocked up, and they said, why don't you go to the toilet, give it a rinse out.
Fantastic.
So trust me, you know, even my one time on live national television, I can still turn it into an embarrassment.
I mean, live is tricky, isn't it? You know, I mean,
it was terrifying.
Yeah, I've discovered that doing these, because I do a live show of this as well with video.
Right.
And, you know, you just think, how hard can it be to talk to people? You know, how hard can it be? And then you realise that, they don't know I've finished speaking, or they don't know I'm about to speak. And you realise that all this stuff has to be sorted out beforehand, really.
Many things can go wrong. And I think what I wasn't prepared for, I was the first one. So, of course, they're timekeeping. And when you're presenting, and I say, I mean, my experience is quite limited. It's not like I did loads of it, but when you're presenting, you've basically got like always got a producer in your ear checking on time, telling you, you know, you've got to keep a check on things. So when you're trying to talk and read out the results of your region, and you've got Andy Peters going, speed up, slow down, take longer, speed up, and you're so that was my in at the deep end. But yeah, that was a long time ago. And then Anime Network came about because of knowing Hugh, lovely Hugh David, and it was something he wanted to do with ADV. And yeah, just both Stu and I had done a bit of presenting, so it kind of came together out of the fun of it.
Right place, right time.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. Sounds like you enjoyed it, though.
Oh, I love anime. I never imagined I'd ever be...
Bit of a dream job.
You know, next up, Neon Genesis. What is going on? What world am I living in? Yeah.
So, okay. So, We've talked about that. So,
sorry.
That's cool. Comics. You've been interested in comics a lot longer, though, haven't you? I mean, when did you start sort of making comics? I'm assuming that, like many of us, you made comics for the pleasure before turned it into a job.
But yeah. What's
that? Did you, you know, start drawing and writing your own comics as a kid, or did it come a little bit later while you were in education, you know, in college? Or
so with, well, I mean, I didn't start making comics till a bit later. I didn't draw my first full comic, like narrative comic page, until I was 20. So I was quite late drawing comics. But what I used to, write stories and I used to draw. And I hadn't quite in my mind put the two together. And then years later, met up with the guys who I'd obviously become part of Sweat Drop with. And that were like, we were like a circle, you call it then, massively inspiring of each other, supporting each other. Mm. So, I mean, I wouldn't be doing it without them, because they were the ones who made me realize it could actually be a thing you could do, not just dream about doing.
Yeah.
But what is funny is years after joining Sweat Drop, we were sharing a house. A bunch of us were sharing a house.
Oh, was it really like that? I didn't realize it was like, I knew you were all working closely together, but I didn't realize you guys were actually living together.
Well, not all of us, but we did end up, like six of us decided to rent a house. And literally, like, Laura Watton was coming back from Japan. Doc had been living somewhere. Like, we'd all been living in disparate places. Mm. And we only knew each other because of meeting at a couple of conventions and talking online. But we're like, hey, guys, let's rent a house. So we probably had, like, Sweat Drop House, where the hub of...
It was so bohemian.
It so was. We had so many... so many nerd things in that house. But what's funny is I remember us all going through old boxes of our stuff one evening, because it was very boho, you know. We'd all like sit there drawing and sharing ideas and stuff. It was really creative. We found a bunch of old sketch pads, and all of us were going through our old sketch pads, and I was totally shamed, because I'd always said, oh, you know, I love telling stories, I love drawing, but I don't think I ever thought this could be a job. And we found these old sketchbooks of, like, little Emma, and I mean, like, really little Emma, drawing a picture that was blatantly just copying a picture from a Clamp comic, and then putting two little boxes at the bottom saying client approved and client not approved, where I would have ticked, like, didn't approve project.
Fantastic.
Like, I'd obviously made up this whole narrative of, like...
Oh, that's brilliant. The things that kids do, eh? It's imagination, isn't it? It's like play and pretend. I love all that when kids do.
Yeah, exactly. So I obviously, while I say I didn't think it was a job, and I didn't think it was a job, I clearly had that desire. I just didn't admit it, you know.
Oh, I love that. That's fantastic. So Sweat Drop sort of started, when was it? It was sort of about... 2004, something like that.
Yeah, something around that. I'm terrible. I should know the date.
I'm only doing it from memory myself.
Because we were we started just before, like, Tokyo Pop came over, or the MCM's got Comet, or Neo Magazine. Like, we were sort of just on the cusp of that stuff. So it must have been about 2000.
I've just checked online, and it was 2002.
Two. Wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
So wow. Amazing. That's 18 years ago. Well, I remember seeing you guys. I remember seeing you guys at the shows, and you always had really nice setup for your tables and things like that. And
I think I probably met you the first time when we did our first venturing out to Bristol Comic Con, because we used to do a lot of the anime cons, and then our first Bristol Con must have been about 2007, I reckon, or like maybe 2005. Mm. Like, that first time we were like, ooh, let's try this wider. Yeah.
We probably met, but I probably didn't know who you were, I would imagine.
And why would you? I was a no one.
and there was a bunch of you as well, you know. It wasn't, you know, there was always at least two or three people behind that table. You know.
Well, that was the beauty of it. And Sweat Drop is still going now. Like, I stepped down quite a long time ago, but as a group, they're still going. And it part of the beauty of it was early on, there's no way I could have... It almost becomes normal now, I think, for young creators. They're going to sit behind a table on their own and sell their stuff. That, to me, was unimaginable back then. Like, the idea of not being part of a group who could support you and who could... Because you can't... It's hard to promote your own work, but you can promote your friend's work.
Yeah.
So we would... We could sit there and be like, oh my God, have you read this comic that this person's made? It's amazing. But then they'd do the same for yours, you know? So the idea of having your own table was almost something you'd aspire to one day, being confident enough to have your own table. So I have a lot of respect for these, let's face it, kids who like come straight along to their first Comic-Con, like, here I am.
I see them all the time at ICE, you know. And you see them at Thought Bubble as well, don't you? These kids who, you know, it might be their first show and they're like about 17 and they've got a couple of comics and they're just there on their own. I mean, I do see them with their dads sometimes and their mums, which I think is really sweet.
That is absolutely, that's the best. Like, parents... bringing their kids around to tables and being like, I want you to see what my kid does. I'm really proud of them. Like, oh my God, this is amazing. How things have changed.
Yeah. my parents, it was always, when are you going to get a job? And, you know.
Yeah. What is that you're doing? I don't...
Yeah, what are you wasting your time?
So Sweat Drop was just like a safe, it was a way of having that support network and learning. And like, I couldn't have dived into making comics without that sort of,
it gave you a training ground, didn't it? A really good training ground. And not just about making comics, but also the publishing side and the selling and all that. So you got a great way of
We became a publisher like a few years after I joined. Mm. It was like a next step. But also we had the forums. Alas, the forums are no more. The modern internet doesn't need them anymore. But for a while we had this amazing, thriving community because part of our remit, because again, none of us were doing it as a job. We didn't really think it could be a job. It was just something you did because you loved it. So we loved like doing reach outs and basically trying to inspire others to get into it. And it's actually really lovely. Even I'm looking to my right now because I've backed a few Kickstarters recently and literally a couple of the ones I've been reading recently, you've got like, you know, Jade Sarson and Shazleen Khan and Sarah Burgess and Rebecca Burgess and this like whole group of creators who I know because they were kids on the Sweat Drop forum, is lovely. So cool.
I see there's a very nice bookshelf behind you, actually. I do make it a sort of tradition now. If people have bookshelves,
it's a mess.
Get them to pick on something and say, oh, is there something that you like in there that you'd like to, that you're proud of or anything like that? I can see a lot of Marvel. Now, is that your stuff or is that stuff that you've read or is it just
We'd be here a long time if I picked out everything I liked, I think. But no, my stuff's all hidden on the bottom, you know, because you've got to have it somewhere. But mine's easy reach reference, but not visible.
Yeah.
Except for the German editions of Life is Strange, which arrived a couple of days ago. So I have to hide them.
Pretty cool.
Anyway,
enough of that. So after Sweat Drop, and there was a period as well, wasn't there, where you were running the Comics Village for MCM? Mm,
yeah.
Was that just like, did they just approach you and say, we'd like
to... So that was literally, at the time, it was Paul and Brian running the event, and they dropped a line to Sweat Drop, I think, because to their credit, they basically said, MCM stands for Movies, Comics and Media, and we don't really have any comics. And for whatever reason, and it's really cool what they did, they decided to reach out to Sweat Drop because they said, we're looking for people who can help us. Basically, we don't know much about comics, so we're looking for people who know a bit more who might be able to help. And then they agreed to come along to Minamicon, which is a little anime con still going in Southampton, which we would go to every year. And they came along and we had a chat with them there. Just kind of something about it sounding really cool. We liked them. So that must have been, I don't know, 2005. Well done. So it started as Sweat Drop setting up a little area where we ran like an art competition, which still happens. And then slowly I started getting more chatty with Brian and saying, like, I think, you know, we could do more. We'd like, let's have a full old comics area. And I dubbed it the Comic Village because I wanted this idea of it.
Great idea.
It's like, you'll remember this. Some people listening might not, but we remember a time when to go to a Comic Con in England, like if you did manga, you were in the manga ghetto. If you did Marvel, you sat with the Marvel people. If you did web comics, you went over there.
It was very ghettoized. Segregated. You know? Yeah.
So I think getting this platform and MCM were great because they said, well, look, the space is subsidized by the rest of the show. So do what you want to do with it. Which was amazing of them to give that to me because I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Learn as you go.
But all I knew I wanted was this idea of this village. I wanted it to be people mixed, like, let's have, you know, Marvel next to web comics, next to manga, next to perceived manga. and just shake it all up and have people talking to each other.
It's a great way of doing it. And it, funnily enough, in 2006, when I did my first show, which was just after that, we had the same sort of notion, really, was to say, why have, you know, small press in one area and pros in another? Why not mix it up? Why not sort of have people? Because if people go to a certain area because they like a certain thing, then they don't see all the other guys.
That's
it, mix it up, it forces them to at least walk past the table. You know?
Well, also, we're all like, for all the, there's lots of facets to us. We're an industry. We're like a whole, we're a big comics family. And we can only be better by mixing it up and being inspired by each other. You know, I love, things are so different now.
It feels weird now. You don't realise how much has changed, do you? I mean, now it seems natural for that to happen. And there's there's more of a blurring of the lines, definitely. I was just talking about it
massively
with somebody else, you know, and it's like, you know, the difference between, you know, a big pro and an indie guy, there's just hardly any difference now in what they can achieve and how they market themselves. It's all starting to come together. And that's, for me, that's great, because
it's really lovely.
It was a struggle,
I can remember early on, and like, we've talked about this before. My relationship with the word manga is quite complicated, but I won't go. That's not what we're going to talk about today. But I can remember when things were like coming up that time. We had that huge wave of like influx of readers, creators. We had that Tokyopop surge, and it was as someone who, like, you know, my uncle's Japanese. I'm very inspired by Japanese comics. Really, really cool. But I can remember us talking at the time, saying the best thing we could hope for this wave is that we've seen waves come and they've gone before. So what you want is the wave to be big enough, and we use this analogy that when it's big enough that it's going to pull along some of the bedrock and the sea bottom with it.
Yeah.
And then although the wave is going to crash, the wave is going to pass, but you want everything to be mingled underneath.
Yeah.
And it's just like
that, so that.
Yeah. That's and good. I think actually we pretty much got there. It feels now, looking around, the industry is richer for it.
Definitely. It's a lot of work, wasn't it? I think a lot of creators like yourself and con organisers and the whole industry together had to put a lot of work in to make that happen, didn't they? And it's, but you look back over the last like 15 years, I guess it's been since the wave started, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see the results, and it's really encouraging. So
yeah, it's really cool.
When you were doing that, somewhere along the line, around, I'm guessing, about 2007, you actually started working as a professional comic artist, didn't you?
Yeah, someone was foolish enough to pay me.
I believe it was Self-Made Hero, wasn't it?
Yes, they were lovely. Yeah. So basically, it's funny because Sonia Leong, and our destinies are so intertwined for things. We were both in Sweat Drop. We both ended up living in the same village. We both entered Rising Stars of Manga for Tokyopop that year, and we both placed. And then we both got picked up by Self-Made Hero pretty much a couple of months or something before that competition. So in that 1 year, we ended up, getting these first contracts. So she was doing Romeo and Juliet and I was doing Hamlet, Self-Made
That's
Hero.
The one, yeah.
And we did the Tokyopop Rising Stars of Manga. And I mean, we're always learning. We are always learning. We never stop learning. But I can honestly say, I'm so proud of what I achieved. But my God, if I have to look at those pages now, I'm just so embarrassed. Because we were so young. Like,
you're learning your craft as you go.
I was massively learning. You know, I definitely was one of those people, I lucked out because I was of a generation that was, as that wave was rising, I think we were lucky. We benefited from it. And that's not to say we didn't work bloody hard for it. But
You still had to produce the work, didn't you? You still had to produce the pages. You know, you still had to go through the motions and you know, when you're doing the work, you're sort of in the moment, aren't you? You know,
well, so much so that it was Hamlet was a 200-page graphic novel adaptation of, you know, Shakespeare, which
that's the difficult enough as it is, isn't it? You know, adapting
could have gone very badly. But I had a full-time job at the time, working for a games company, and I ended up finishing that book with pneumonia and a gas mask on because I think I underestimated, because I thought, well, I can't quit my day job. It's not like comics is going to be a job.
Yeah,
it's just a book.
Yeah.
And actually, as it turned out, in that weird positive out of a negative, I think I got so poorly that I couldn't carry on with my day job. And actually, in hindsight, I probably wouldn't have had the courage to take that leap and go freelance. So that was like my push moment. Yeah. And as it turned out, thankfully, touch wood, it hasn't stopped since, and I've carried on learning.
When you made that decision, then was it always going to be, you know, if you had to choose between the two, was it always going to be the leap into comics?
See, again, things are different now. I know it's really hard to kind of pass this in what was happening in 2007, what comics felt like then. Mm. But I don't think I felt like it could be a feasible decision. You know, if someone had said to me when I first got the Hamlet contract, I mean, it was crazy exciting. I can remember turning to my mum at one point and being like, I've just had a phone call with my editor. I've got an editor. Like, it was super exciting. But if someone had said, oh, would you quit your day job then to do this? I think, honestly, I would have thought, this isn't a job. Like, I can't, you know, what I do in the day is a job. Mm. And I loved it as well. This is just a crazy fantasy. Like, So I don't think I would have been confident or had the confidence to do that. Because I think having the courage to believe in yourself enough that you're willing to place all your bets on,
yeah,
being a job,
oh yeah, yeah. Like, so when you got ill and it was like, well, I've got to do one or the other, that must have been a tricky decision to make then, because
it was out of my hands. I literally got so ill, I was bedridden for,
oh dear,
like 3 months.
So you couldn't
or
go to work, basically, then.
I couldn't go to work. I was signed off work. They were very good to me, actually. I ended up working for them for like a consultancy basis for a short while. But I had to finish the book. And then, so it just sort of, the way it worked out is by the time, I can't remember what came after Hamlet. Something was signed. I literally can't remember what exactly came after it. But basically another job followed quite soon after.
Much Ado About Nothing, I think.
Well, that was a couple of years later.
So there was something in between.
It might have been the DFC by then, maybe.
Oh, yeah, the DFC.
So I think whatever it was, something came along that made me think, all right, maybe this isn't just one job. Like, you know, you feel like this is it. This is the one book I'm getting the chance to draw. Mm. And then when another possible job came up, it was like, oh, maybe I'm okay at this. Like, maybe there's a, you know, maybe I'll get more jobs. So, yeah.
So you managed to fill the time then between the two jobs.
Yeah, yeah. 15 years later, thankfully.
And so, obviously, I mean, we did talk briefly about your relationship with the word manga. And I think basically, I mean, would it be right to say that because you did those two jobs, you know, the manga jobs, and they were successful, did you feel that you were getting typecast, if you like, as a manga creator, as opposed to just a comic artist?
You know, I'd have no, it's weird. We won't delve too deep, but no. I mean, for me, it literally is as simple as that manga is comics. You know, I would never, ever want to put down manga or anyone creating what they would call themselves as being manga, because it's amazing. And absolutely, when Sweat Drop started out, that was what, the way I put it to people in conversations is, the reason we loved manga and what it was about manga at the time, the Japanese industry that inspired us, was at a time when Western comics felt quite narrow. Yes. Only because that was what I could see. It felt like Western comics, you know, the house style was still a thing, which thank goodness that's gone now. It felt like there was a certain way to make comics and they had to be about certain things. Whereas the Japanese industry was saying, if you want to make comics about anything you like, in any style you like, it was so broad. And that was what was so magical about manga, was so vast. And you could draw however you wanted about anything you cared about. And it was valid. Yeah. The irony was that over time, as manga got picked up over here as a bigger term, the perception of what it was got smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, it got narrow.
We loved, right? Yeah. So suddenly it became you do manga, you must draw Pokemon. Or you do manga, you must draw Akira. Like, you clearly, everything you do is either for kids or tentacle porn. And it's like, it was really bizarre that everything that was great about it was its diversity.
Yeah.
And everything that it got known for over here was its limitations, which I found really strange. And I think for me, the turning point, and I never name names on the story because it's not fair, because we're in different times now, but I was doing a job in Spain, like really lovely comic event with a couple of very respected people who I respect now. One was a creator, one was sort of, was managing the event and stuff. And we went into this lovely bookshop, which was also a publisher, and it was surrounded by these, like, just comic, like so many varied comics. I fell in love with the place. Like, oh, this is gorgeous. What a brilliant selection of books we're looking at here. And the person who was sort of hosting us introduced us to the owner and to the other creator. They said, this is X and he makes comics, and this is Emma and she does manga. And the owner looked at me, and I'll never forget him saying, ah, we don't sell manga here.
Oh, really?
And I said, well, what do you count as manga? Because like, comics is manga. And we had a bit of a laugh. And then he said, anyway, look around the shop. And I was walking around the shop and I came across a section that was all Jiro Taniguchi comics. They were doing like a highlight of him. And I called over to the guy and said, oh, look, you do manga. And he just went, we don't class that as manga.
Really?
And my internal, and this was, bear in mind, it was years ago, but my internal voice wanted to say back, what, because it's not shit?
Yeah.
Is that why you don't class it as manga? Yeah. And so when I say my relationship with it's complicated, it is complicated because I never want to look like I'm putting it down. What the Japanese industry did was it rejuvenated a whole industry. Like, it's fresh, it's vast, it's broad, it's wonderful.
But it brought people into the industry as well. You know?
Yeah, but there was a tendency here to start, people would get a look in their eye. The moment you were introduced as a manga artist, they would be like, I literally had people saying, I don't want to see your portfolio, we don't deal in manga. It became that limiting.
Yeah.
And I think what I do and what I did, who can describe their own work, but it's very, I think what I have is like a weird mishmash of, yes, I grew up reading manga, but I'm also Italian. I grew up reading Dylan Dog and a lot of Bonelli and black and white comics from Italy.
Yeah.
And then I grew up with X-Men and Garfield. And so it's sort of like this, what now we would see as totally normal. New creators now are creating in whatever the hell style they like. Because
yeah, it's so varied. Yeah.
There's a mishmash of things they're being exposed to, which is great. But back then, I think there was still that stigma of you draw what you're inspired by and you can only be categorized as that thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is complicated.
People do like to pigeonhole you, don't they? You know,
I get it. I do get it for the sake of marketing and retail back then. I do get it. But I think it was always that the weird thing for me was that I never called myself that. So no. I don't mind you calling me that, but don't judge me for the thing that you called me. Like, because that's not what I presented myself as, you know?
Yeah, it was
a bit bizarre. Thankfully, nowadays, it seems petty and things have changed so much. It doesn't seem as important now. But back then, it felt.
Yeah, like I can imagine. It. Yeah, definitely. So moving on from self-made hero stuff, you then got, obviously you started your own book, Breaks, in what I believe
was a jump.
I'm making a bit of a jump there, aren't I? We're going back 5 years.
It probably scarily wasn't as much of a jump as it feels like it is, because I've been making it so long.
Probably about a 4-year jump, probably there, where you did, like, I suppose you could say, bits and bobs, really.
Well, I did Vampire Academy. This is where I'm going to embarrass myself because I'll forget. Yeah, so I don't remember the order, but it was Vampire Academy for Penguin Random House. It was a 3-book adaptation with them.
Yeah.
I had 2 books with Oni Press. The Avalon Chronicles. Mm. I did Alex Rider was in there.
Of course,
somewhere.
Alex Rider. Shouldn't forget that.
And then doing bits for DC and Marvel. There's been like, I used to joke about I don't really have one thing I want to do. I still now say that I kind of have this whole thing about comics should be for anyone, about anything, by anyone, which is the acronym FAB, which I call.
Oh, I like that. That's good.
Quite like, yeah. And so I think I kind of live by that because I quite like jumping around and doing like.
Well, I was going to say that. Is your sort of bibliography around that time so varied because that was your intention? Because you wanted to do lots of different things and
experiments. I wanted to learn and I wanted to do... I think I spent some time working with French. I was doing My Little Pony in France and Tara Duncan in France. There was all sorts of stuff. And I think just incredible. Because I didn't know what my... I didn't know what my thing was.
You were still sort of finding it. You were still experimenting with your style. Because I've noticed that your visual style has changed over the years so much, you know?
Yeah,
it's become more
so.
Defined now. I mean, I look at your recent stuff and I think, that's Emma's stuff. I could see it. You know?
Oh, really? That's cool.
There's little traits of your work, the way you draw that I can see is definitely yours, you know? Whereas in the past, that wasn't so obvious. And it looked like it was definitely still developing, you know.
Yeah. Well, we don't often, I think I've had this conversation with a few artists, we don't often see our own style, do we? We don't.
No.
I think most people think their own style is completely generic. And we think, oh, my stuff's not recognisable. No one would know.
Until someone else brings
used
it up.
To it.
Yeah.
So I still get a little, if someone says, oh, I recognise that, I thought it was you, I'll be like, oh, that's nice. Mm. But certainly it has. I mean, I can chart my own, like, and I'm sure it will change again, but there's the kind of cliche, isn't there, and which is absolutely true. When you're drawing comics, the trick is to draw what you find your own style, because it's what you want to draw, not because it's what you're seeing, because we'll always get inspired by things we see, and every time we pick up a different book we think, oh, I want to work like that, oh, I want to work like that. But you'll always be chasing, if you're doing that, you're always chasing something that's already passed over. So I think I'm one of those creators that my stuff's just sort of, it has changed. It's bound to change, and it goes along whatever I feel inspires me at the time that I want to make. But what is interesting is there was definitely, and I can admit it to myself now, there was a point going into Vampire Academy especially. So that was working for Penguin, and that was actually for my editor was Rob Valois, or Valois as he says, but I can't not call him Valois, who he was a Tokyo Pop editor.
That
was how he knew me.
It's around 2011, isn't it, Vampire Academy? That sort of time.
Yes, probably. It must be. And I loved that series. But it's really interesting, when I look at my art in that now, what I see is this really weird character style with really tiny eyes and really long faces. And I think probably because subconsciously I was trying to fight this, like, I'm not a manga artist.
So I'm going to go the opposite direction to the manga
house style, as it were. Right?
Which,
of course, there is. I was the one who kept saying, and I still stand by it, there is no manga style. You cannot compare Naruto with Tekken Kinkri. They're all different. And I'd obviously got so worked up with this idea of what I was being classed as that I must have subconsciously tried to fight it. And I look at my style back then, I think it's very odd. I was obviously trying to fight something.
Subconscious.
Yeah.
You know, you probably didn't even consciously think that you were intending to do that. And I think artists...
It's fascinating.
I think we do that, don't we, sometimes? And it's like when people say, oh, yeah, I'm influenced by this thing and that thing. And a lot of the time, you don't even realise you've been influenced by something, do you?
I think, actually, for me, there was a huge turning point. I can even tell you exactly when it was. And it was when the first job I did for IDW was taking over Gem and the Holograms.
Oh, right, I remember that.
That was from Sophie Campbell. And now Sophie, it was another one, along with me, Becky, Amy Reed. Like, we'd come through that Tokyo Pop route.
Yeah.
And I was such a fan of Sophie's, I still am such a fan of Sophie's. I think she's just amazing. And so to jump in on a title like Gem was terrifying. But what was interesting is I didn't want to jump too far from what Sophie had been doing. Obviously, I wanted to make it my own, but I knew how much readers were following her stuff. And my God, you don't want to be the one who breaks Gem. Like, it's such a beautiful comic. And so what was interesting is Sophie's stuff still had that stylistic hangover from stuff she was doing before. Obviously, because we're artists, we're going to have a certain way we work.
Yeah.
It was the first time, I'm trying to work out how to word this correctly, and especially because the colours were so bubblegum, fantastic. Yes. It had such a strong visual. So it had, and again, with my complications with the word, it had what people could refer to as being, ooh, it's a bit of a manga aesthetic.
Yeah.
So it was the first time that I was working for a bigger Western publisher on a bigger Western title, and yet it was like I was being given permission, what you do is okay.
Yeah.
We're not going to judge you for it. We're not going to kick you out because the eyes are too big. So it was probably the first time that I was able to draw in a way that I wasn't always feeling like there was this virtual person over my shoulder criticizing it.
Yeah.
And I think it felt like it really freed me up, because it was the first job where I was like, oh God, I can draw in a way I enjoy and it will be accepted.
Yeah, so you could relax a little bit and just enjoy the whole process.
Yeah. So I think things changed a lot with that job, actually, for me, just in how I approached my own work, just feeling a bit, the manga ghetto felt less of a threat.
Well, like you say, you were almost like given permission to do what you wanted to do, whether it was sort of manga-esque, I'm putting up my fingers in inverted commas,
exactly.
or not. You know, you were basically, we they obviously hired you because they saw your work and they liked what you did. And you
I think for like it's fascinating that there were, even before that, you had, you know, huge comics out there like Scott Pilgrim and Brian Lee O'Malley is unashamedly inspired by manga. And no one would have called Scott Pilgrim manga.
No.
I don't know if that was a boy-girl thing, who knows? But there were certain comics that could be absolutely inspired by Japanese comics without being classed as this weird, separate thing.
There was a whole section of slave labor stuff that was definitely manga. You know, it doesn't matter what you say, it was definitely, it was manga inspired, without a doubt. A whole
which
generation.
Which creators would say, loads of us are. But for some reason, there was only certain things got picked out as being separated out as actually being, they're manga. Yeah, it's very strange. It's always complicated.
But, it is strange.
But so Gem was a bit of a turning point. That was very cool.
And we will, and going back to breaks, I'm determined to.
Thank you.
So that started in 2014, which I now find hard to believe, but I do know it was 2014, because you started it around the same time that I started doing ICE, which was 2014. And I think you came to the show and you was like promoting that and promoting some other stuff as well.
Yeah, well, I did Think Tank with you before, and I can't remember if I was doing breaks at that point. I think the first digital page for breaks went online in February 2013. I think was the first pages went online, like in the webcomic, which is crazy now. It is so weird.
And breaks, I mean, it's been published since, hasn't it, in print?
Yeah.
By Soaring Penguin, was it?
Yeah, Soaring Penguin's been great. So John Anderson early on was quite... what was nice with John is that he'd been reading it. And so even before Malin Ryden being my co-creator, before we really knew, all we knew with breaks when we started is that, and there's a whole weird story of how it came about, which I've told a billion times before, but once we did start the comic... we just knew we wanted it to be read for free because we wanted it's for anyone, but we wanted especially teenagers to be able to read it because there was stuff that there was stuff that mattered to us and we wanted certain audiences to be able to, it had to be accessible basically. So we were like, well, we'll do it as a webcomic. We'll do it for free. How we're going to make money out of it, we have no idea. I still don't.
That's comics.
But it was one of those things where, like, this is a passion project we're doing. We want it seen above all else. So we were giving it away for free. And John actually was reading it and he would care about it. And I'd see him at a convention and he'd be like, oh, this point when Cortland did this. So it was nice because following it along. And then when the first book was coming close to being done, he said, well, would you let us print it? Why don't we print it? And I think we'd been toying with, like, what are we going to do with this book? Yeah. It's very much our book. It's very hard to sell to people because it doesn't fit into any particular gimmick.
Well, it's so character-driven, isn't it? That's the thing. It's about the characters more than anything else. You know, it's not I suppose you could say it's got themes, obviously. But they're not, you can't sort of sum them up in an elevator pitch very easily.
It's very slice of life. Like I can nutshell the story and the concept, but I can't say, it's a bit tricky to say to someone, oh, if you like superheroes, you're like this. Or if you like spies, you're like it.
To its credit, that's why it's so great, is because it doesn't fit into all those little niches that already exist. You know, it is its own thing. It's so unique.
Maybe. I hope so. I mean, I'd say now, it feels less unique now. Again, it's that weird thing of trying to remember in 2013 what was out and what was available. Yeah. And obviously, it's a queer comic. It's LGBTQI positive. But also, we didn't want to go into it promoting it as that. Like, we didn't want to be like, hey, guys, it's an LGBT
comic. Because that's not all it is. That's the thing, isn't it? It's not, yes, that's part of it, but it's so much more than that as well.
Yeah, and also, we didn't want to feel like other audience members, potential audience members someone might not pick it up if they think, oh, well, it's not for me. So the last thing you want to do is say it's this because you don't want someone to feel cut out from it. It's really tricky. So when Soaring Penguin, it seemed a perfect solution because it's an independent deal. You know, it's not a money deal, but it was people who we liked and who we trusted who they basically got content to print for free and we got our book distributed in a way that we couldn't have. So it meant that if someone in Canada wanted to buy it, they can, because Soaring Penguin can get it to them. It was in shops because they could put it in shops. So it was something I couldn't have achieved on my own. So it works out nicely for everyone because it means it's sort of, it's out there.
Yeah.
And now here we are halfway through arc three, which is arc, finally.
Is it? Is it coming to an end then, Briggs?
It is finally.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I always imagined it never to end. I thought it was going to go on forever. I thought it was going to be your sort of magnus opus, you know?
The beauty with Breaks is that it's a complete story from beginning to end. It's always been a complete story because we wrote it in prose first and it's got a very clear end point. And because of that, I mean, if we were working on it in normal speed, if I was getting paid to do it as a job or if my Patreon had soared and I'd managed to get enough through Patreon to do it as a job, I could have got the whole, but it would have been a book a year. You know, the fact that it's been this slow is only because I have to do a book, a page a week, because I'm doing it alongside other jobs.
Yeah.
So it's slow because of the way it's being released, not because of how many pages it is. But it's so great because it's so complete that all the twists and turns in it, nothing is accidental. Like, it's all very controlled. We know where it's going. And the pain of making a comic for coming up 10 years...
When you know what's happening.
We know what's coming.
Yeah, it must be quite hard to stick with it, actually, because you know what's good, you know, because there's no surprises for you, you know, because a lot of creators make it up as they go along, don't they?
But the joy of it being a webcomic, and we've got like a small but lovely following online, and it's so amazing when something happens and we get that communication with them. And
I wanted to ask, actually, what the feedback has been like from the readers.
It's been really overwhelming in some ways. Like, some of it, we've had, I know it's slightly cliche because, you know, if someone finds a comic that means something to them, that's everything the creator wants. But for us to have young people especially saying, well, it's been a combination. The audience hasn't been necessarily everything we've expected it to be. It's been way more broad than we expected. But we might have young people saying that they've come out because they've read the comic, or we have people who've been dealing with bullying and finding ways to come around that, or like people who, and we've got older readers whose kids are going through the things that the kids in the comics are going through, so that's something I hadn't foreseen. We've got like queer couples who've been married for years who were able to read the comic and see exactly what they went through when they were coming to that realization of who they were. We've even got one particular reader who the bit she empathizes with is more that Ian's dad's in jail and her dad was in jail, and so she so it's like there's all these things because it is a real life story. And while we want it to be dramatic, and it is dramatic, so we'll take license here and there, but as a rule we try and keep it as believable as like everything in it is dramatic but believable.
Yeah, you want it to be entertaining, like, as well, don't you? You don't just want it to be a series of events, do you?
Totally. So we've had, like, people will pick up on facets of it that we maybe didn't realize would resonate with people the way they have.
That's really cool.
Which is really nice. I used to think I would be able to predict at a convention if someone was approaching the table, I would know whether they were going to approach me for breaks or something else. I've been proved wrong, entirely wrong.
I thought I was the only one who played that game.
Yeah, we all do it, don't we?
What are they going to buy? What are they interested in? Because obviously when I did Scar Comics, we had about five or six different titles and they were all very different.
Right.
So we'd sit there behind the table and say, right, what are they going to look at? Oh, it's going to be Falling Sky. And then, no, they liked, you know, Madam
You can't Sarah. Predict.
I'd never imagined. I'm so surprised that they like that book, you know. So
I've been really pleasantly surprised by that,
And comics readers do that, don't they? They do surprise you sometimes.
We're good, it's been an epic project. So the idea of being on the final arc and finally telling the story that's sort of been, it's one of those stories that is, it's a very slow burn story, no question. It's slow burn. So I'm so grateful to readers who've for 8 years been reading one page a week. Is incredible. But when it does have a twist, it will kind of give you that mini payoff. And then it's one of the stories that until you get the end of it, it doesn't, everything else is going to click into place when that end happens. And so for Malin and I, we're just so excited to get that told, you know.
And when will that come out? Sorry, Em.
Well, it still won't be for a little while because, I mean, technically, what's frustrating, I mean, you'll know, like, on a creator level, we've got about four issues left of it, four issues worth of pages, which if I was working full-time on it, you know, I'd have it done in 5 months, six months.
Yeah.
As it is,
and I'm not to put down any of my other jobs I'm working on, because I feel very lucky at the moment with what I'm working on, but it means that breaks has to happen in my spare time. Yeah. So it's I'm still having
we're probably looking at somewhere near the end of next year then, are we? You reckon?
Hopefully next year, I think. I mean, I could sit and do the maths. It's like, what, average 22 pages an issue, about 4 issues, maybe add an extra 15 pages because we want to take our time and tell it right, and then break that number of pages down by 1 page a week.
Whoa.
So that'll tell you how long it is. So
I'm not very good at maths, but I can tell it's going to be a while. But I look forward to it. I really look forward to seeing it.
But we'll keep ticking it over every week on the webcomic, so it's sort of always present. We're just very lucky to have some great readers. So
yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about a webcomic, isn't it? Just going into that, is that you do retain that interest from the readers. You know, it's not, you're not having to wait months between putting out a print comic.
Grateful to it.
Yeah.
There's no way I could have maintained motivation if on a project for this long without online readers. Like, readers generally are why we do this. Like, you need readers. They're the backbone of it. We wouldn't be able to make comics without them. But web comics has brought us closer to them than we ever have before. So, you know,
it's very instant, isn't it? It's a very instant backwards and forwards with web stuff.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And I really like, I've got some readers who I've known their names now for years, because you know, some of them are now my patrons as well. And then I'll see them at a comic con, and then we're like, bless them, bring a boost bar to the table, or bring a boost bar, you know. And so it becomes more than just these are readers of my comic. It becomes like this is this community that's been around this comic, and it's beautiful. I love
it. Lovely. That's really nice. Mm. And so we're nearly at the end, because I can't believe how quick it's gone, actually. It's just whizzed by. It always does. I say this at the end of every podcast. It's like, wow, that went quick. I shouldn't be surprised anymore. So as well as all your own stuff and the stuff that you did earlier on in your career, you have done a lot of stuff for what we would call, I guess, mainstream comics as well.
Yeah.
Right? You've done some stuff. You did some, was it, I'm trying to remember, is this from memory? some Wonder Woman, I think.
I did a very small bit of Wonder Woman. So basically did a very small bit of Wonder Woman. I did a couple of issues of Supergirl. Kieran and Jamie very graciously let me
Wicked and Divine
join in on Young Avengers and Wicked
Young
and Divine.
Avengers. Young Avengers. Was that fun? Did you enjoy that?
Oh my god, I loved it so hard. Like, basically Kieran, I mean, obviously with Jamie and Kieran, I've been friends for a very long time anyway, so the whole thing's lovely. And when they were first getting that job, I was such a huge Young Avengers fangirl, and I can remember and Kieran being like, right, tell me about Young Avengers, what do I need to know? And I remember him saying in an interview for that after party for Young Avengers that he was like, we basically knew that if we didn't let Emma draw Billy and Teddy, she'd punch us. So I pretty much bullied my way into that.
Brilliant.
It was lovely. Really nice to be part of that. I've kind of jumped around very much like elusive guest artist more than anyone who's stuck around. I'm kind of that person. We need a fill-in issue. Who's around?
Well, it's good to have that talent. It's good to be able to hop onto a title like that and just fill in, because it can really get you a lot of work, can't it? I know a lot of guys who, you know, before they found their sort of thing that they did on a regular basis, that's might be all they did for a few years.
I'm really grateful for it. It's all opportunities, isn't it? And I feel really lucky that I've been able to do those, because I mean, I'm a comics fan at heart, and I'm a Marvel girl, so getting to I say that, I mean, obviously I really enjoyed Supergirl and Wonder Woman as well, not to put those down at all, but when I get to work with those guys, it's obviously, who's not going to enjoy that? It's pretty cool. But also I've done a few things now. IDW have treated me very well. I've obviously Gem, and then Back to the Future.
Oh, Back to the Future,
G.I. Joe.
That was a good one.
So they've treated me very well. And now, and what's nice is that Denton Tipton, who I know because of IDW, he's now got Magma as his new line under heavy metal. And that's who Paul and I are doing Modern Frankenstein with.
Ah, right. Exciting.
And then, of course, there's Titan, who also, well, not only let me draw Doctor Who. my doctor, but... But then let me write Life is Strange. Not draw it, but write it, which was, I'm so grateful to them for.
Would you say, out of the two processes, is your favourite? I know it's a bit of a silly question, but I'm allowed one or two, aren't I?
I don't think it's a writing, silly question at all.
Writing and drawing, you know, what's it?
I could genuinely talk about it for ages. I remember when I remember when I first started, like literally first issue, because I'd written comics before. Obviously, I write comics for me before, and I'd written very small things. Like I did something for Made Fire, and like I've done little bits that other artists have drawn, but never something that, again, inverted commas, like mainstream, like a bigger title. So it felt like a huge risk. But when I finished, I think the first issue or the first couple of issues in, I remember talking with. Well, I had two conversations but about the same thing, one with Mark Buckingham and one with Becky Cloonan. And obviously, because there's a few artists now who are doing more writing. And we all basically said, when we first tried writing an issue, our initial thought was, I am never drawing a comic again. Like, because it was like, I can write things into being in a week that are going to take me over a month to draw.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, it was so eye-opening and so wonderful. But that, I think that was that honeymoon period for me of writing as a poet and getting to have a wonderful artist like Claudia Leonardi giving pages back and how that felt and just thinking,
seeing what they've done with your story as well. Because the good artist always does, you know, is a storyteller, aren't they?
Yes,
so
exactly.
Their contribution can be huge. And it's really nice, isn't it? You write, maybe you do it as a script or a plot or however you do it. And then the artist comes back with something little bit different.
They're the director, you know. It's always underestimated how much an artist puts into a title.
Agree.
And I can say that as a writer as well as an artist, like it has to be a collaboration between the two. So initially that honeymoon period of writing, I thought, oh god, why would I put myself through drawing comics when I can write them? But it's interesting how, and I still love writing, but it probably only took 5 or 6 issues of writing to feel myself going, I really miss
drawing.
I just want to turn off, because there's such different disciplines, you can't compare them. Like writing, the actual act of tapping away at a keyboard, sure, that bit is quicker, like no question, that is way less taxing than drawing a comic. But I think what I'd underestimated writing for someone else and not just for myself was that I never turned off. Like it was just, whereas with drawing, I like the act of sitting at the beginning of the day, you get your cup of coffee, you put some music or a podcast or some crappy TV on in the background, you knuckle down and you think, right, this is me for the next 8-9 hours.
Yeah.
I'm sat drawing this page and it's all, sometimes it's stressful, but sometimes it's quite soothing because that's, you're just immersed and you're drawing someone else's story or your own. I mean, I have to say my ideal, like the thing I love more than anything, is obviously getting to write and draw my own stuff is great, but they're all different. So getting to draw someone's story is like a privilege and it just feels quite relaxing. Whereas writing, for all that it's a quicker, the actual manual act of typing a script is quicker.
But that's not all it is.
You've got months of your head going in circles before you get to that point. And also the pressure of feeling like, oh God, if I mess this up, like I could... You can draw something badly, and I frequently do, and feel...
I'll get away with that.
If a story is strong, I probably shouldn't admit it, but like if a story of writing is strong enough, I feel like there are definitely readers out there who'll follow a writer, and if the art dips one issue, it sounds like I'm being negative.
They'll forgive it.
I'm trying not to be negative, but they'll forgive it. Whereas when you're writing, you feel like, if I've messed this up, I really messed this up.
And it's harder to tell, isn't it? It's harder to tell that you've messed it up, I think. Because you can get so immersed. Yeah, well, it reads all right to me. I think it's all right. I think that's a good story. I think it works.
Right.
And then you've just missed something, you know, and you don't see it.
It's stressful.
Yeah.
So it's a different level of stress. And I've found a different level of engagement as a writer, especially because I'm writing a title that's obviously Life is Strange has got a lot of passionate followers. It's what makes it so wonderful. I'm one of them. So it's not like I was just writing a fresh story that no one knows. When you're writing for a license, it comes with a whole
There's an expectation, isn't there? Yeah,
which I hadn't expected it, and it's been a learning curve on that. So I can't genuinely couldn't say, like, when I'm writing and drawing, they're all completely different. And at the moment, I feel so grateful because I get to write and draw breaks. I get to write Life is Strange and I get to draw Modern Frankenstein. So I'm literally getting to, like, so long as I don't go crazy or break myself, I'm getting to do all three. So.
But that is the best of both worlds, really, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, they're all so different. Like, I mean, it's the thing I always come back to with comics is, again, going back to almost what we said about manga earlier, comics is everything. Comics can be everything, whether what you're telling, what you're reading, what you're making, like, it's so versatile and so varied, and that's what I love about it because I have no attention span. So yeah, as long as I get to keep playing and, you know, using comics in different ways.
And you say about no attention span, I find that a real common trait with creative people. You know, not all, some people don't work that way, but a lot of creative people, myself included, I need to be infused by something. And I always have to be finding something new to get excited about and to create. Once something becomes routine, I find it really hard to stay into it, you know. And that's where the discipline comes in, isn't it?
You've got to be that discipline.
Yeah, disciplined. Have you struggled with that over the years, that discipline?
Weirdly, I think I'm a bit weird. Well, no, I'm not weird. I'm just, I'm quite good with discipline. I'm actually horribly anal when it comes to scheduling. I remember sitting with Charlie and having this conversation years ago when he was deep in Walking Dead territory. We were talking about how we would break down, and it turns out we both operate on the same system. We talk about banking time. So I will work out, if I've got a schedule coming up, and anyone who's worked with me knows how picky I am on this, I go into that looking, I'm looking 8 months ahead, 9 months ahead. I've broken down everything by days, by hours. I know exactly what I have to do every day, to the point where I know that, oh, if I work an extra few hours today and then an extra few hours tomorrow, I could probably get that extra page done, which means I've banked a day, which means that then if I'm ill or if I need to take a day off, I can. So when it comes to schedule, I'm actually quite boring on so I'll be that creator who's messaging my editors 3 months in advance going, we're going to have a problem by the time we hit the end of that month. We're going to have a problem. We need to fix it now. So on that, I'm quite good. So I'd say that's a form of discipline. But what I do struggle with, and I realized it most this year, is I have, and this is, let's not delve into my brain and the darker side, but I have to feel like I'm doing something for a reason. What I'm really bad at, I'd love to be the sort of creative who's like, oh, I'm going off to a cabin in the middle of nowhere and I'm going to spend a year creating my opus. I'm not that person because that's when I lose any motivation. I need an element of stress and an element of pressure of like why I'm doing it. And early on this year, when the first round of COVID was with us, I feel very grateful that things have turned around now. But for a good few months, I was one of those people, Life is Strange was put on hold. All my jobs were canceled. So I was essentially out of work for whatever it was, 4 or 5 months. And I thought, wow, what a great opportunity to work on breaks. What a great opportunity to get all these pitches done for all my original stuff that I want to do.
That's the plan.
And obviously, the result was I did nothing because I couldn't cope because I didn't have a plan. I had no...
You were just left to the devices, I guess, then. And that's when it gets difficult, isn't it? I've struggled with that myself. And this is it's part of why I started doing these... podcasts was because all the other creative stuff I was doing during the lockdown period, I found it really hard to structure it. But because this is episodic, it's done at a certain time, you know, it has to be done. Like when I've arranged a podcast with somebody, I can't then sort of go, oh, I'm not going to do it now.
Yeah,
although I did cancel yesterday with you.
I double booked.
But that's the first time that's happened, by the way. You have to have the structure there. And I think subconsciously, I forced myself into that because I knew that's good, I wasn't going to achieve anything creatively if I didn't.
It's why I did breaks as a webcomic, because I knew if I was left to my own devices with it, I'd struggle. But knowing I have a schedule, knowing I have to put a page up every week, it's going to make
people
me
are
do
expecting it.
It,
aren't they?
Yeah. So I'm disciplined in terms of schedule. Like if I'm on a job, I like to think, you know, touch wood, I've never, 15 years, I've never missed a deadline. I will be to the point of frustrating on my schedules to people because I'll be that annoying person. So I'm disciplined in that way, but I'm not creatively disciplined. Like if I'm left to my own devices, I think I'd
create some mad self-indulgent thing.
But this is why we know this about ourselves, and that's why it's good that we're in a world now where between stuff like, you know, webcomics, podcasts, Patreon, we've got ways of like imposing that discipline on ourselves and saying to our readers, please be my discipline. Yeah. You discipline me. You're my bosses.
So that's a good way of doing it. Well, Emma, thank you so much for this evening. I've really enjoyed our chat. It's been really good.
Thank you.
And thank you for sticking with it for a little bit longer than the normal hour.
I talk a lot. This is why I lost my voice. I'm glad I had a voice to be able to do it now.
Well, I was worried that, you know, I didn't want to put your voice under too much pressure by keeping you on too long.
It's feeling okay. It's tired, so I'm gonna rest it now. But no, it's due. I would have said if it was struggling. It's been a weird year, very weird year for that.
It has indeed.
Yeah. So extra I had a lot weird of stuff to talk about.
Yeah. Well, I'm very happy to be the one that gets the talking to.
It's been like I wasn't expecting. It's all like a this is your life. We've gone through.
That's
I'm
pretty
sure
much what
some
we
I've
did.
Forgotten. Yeah. But,
oh, yeah. I'm sure. Well, we'll get together again at some point. We'll have to get you onto the live show when Breaks is about to finish, I think.
And we'll talk about that.
We'll do a promotional show about that, and we'll do a Breaks retrospective or something like that. With you and the other creator.
And Malin. Yeah, that'd be amazing.
That would be fantastic if we could do that.
And, honestly, when we finally finish that book, we're going to want to do all the things. I'm going to be so
big
proud.
Big celebration.
Of getting to the end of it. So,
Well, I'm really looking forward to reading the end of it, and you know, it can't come too soon. And,
thank you.
So we'll definitely do something with that. And thank you so much for tonight, Emma. It's been a really good chat. Thanks for coming on and putting
thank
up
you.
With my chatter. And
awesome.
I hope that you you know, enjoy the rest of this year. I hope things get better
for you
all
too,
of us.
For everyone.
Yeah, for all of us.
Well, my husband is about to come home with fish and chips, so this evening is only about to get better. So
the night is sorted then, isn't it?
Exactly. Excellent.
He's a keeper, isn't he, eh?
Well, good job.
Well, I'll say goodnight to you then, Emma. Enjoy your fish and chips.
Take care,
all the best to you. Good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.